No, I don't hear of anything that ties them together, but I rediscover qualities in them, some of which I like and some of which I don't. They're nakeder when they're out of context. But no, I certainly don't hear any kind of thematic tie, not at all. Each show is so different that I can't imagine that they have any thematic ties. Certainly not lyrically. They might musically, because I think musical style persists as you grow up. I was going to say older, but as you write more is what I mean. So I think you can start to hear techniques that you use over and over again, certain chord progressions, rhythmic motifs, but not in terms of thematic material, lyrically, no.
Oscar Hammerstein was an early influence and I think even model on your career. How do you think your form of music theater departs from his?
I don't think it really does. I think it's the essential outgrowth. He also experimented, he didn't only just tell chronological story forms. Allegro was a highly experimental show. It was their first flop, Rodgers and Hammerstein, the third show they wrote. And a number of shows I've done have been very influenced by that. I was 17 at the time, and I was his assistant on that show, so I knew it intimately. But it was their only attempt, really, at experimental theater, and yet it comes out of what they essentially contributed to musical theater, which is having equal respect for story and song. And I do, too. So I find that my work is very related to his, even though the themes and the people and the locales are quite often different, and even the treatments. That is to say, I like experimenting with the form of musical theater. So did Oscar. It's just that he retreated from it early on because he got burned by a failure.
Have you ever written songs outside of the music theater context? Written songs or scores to be... Well, I know you've written Stravinsky for a movie score, but other than that, just a song to be a pop song, for instance. And why does music theater interest you more than, say, a pop song?
Oh, because I'm interested in characters and events. I'm interested in plays. I'm as interested in theater as I am in songs, that's why. Rarely have I done it. I've done it for parties. That is to say, a birthday song for somebody or for an occasion of some sort. But that's the same thing as writing a scene in a show, because you have a character in a situation and then you write for that situation. It's so-and-so's 50th birthday or it's so-and-so's anniversary. So it's the same thing. No, I've always been equally interested in the theater. And therefore would never occur to me to write a song. I wouldn't even know how to go about just writing a song. I'd have to invent a situation, pretend it was a play, and then write it. But that's no fun. I think it'd be much more fun to write 13 songs for a bigger situation.
A lot of your songs have real specificity to help define that character or define the scene that's unfolding in the theater. How do you balance that specificity with enough kind of generalization so that the song can be sung outside of that show?
I don't, which is why my songs aren't sung outside the shows. I've only had one hit and one semi-hit of my own music. Seven of the Clowns was a hit. It was a freak because it was a hit 2 years after the show had opened. I mean, it was only because Judy Collins picked it up and it became big in England, and then Frank Sinatra heard it, and it was lucky. And then the opening number of Forum is played a lot, but mostly as commercials and introductions to TV shows, a song called Comedy Tonight. But I've written other songs of what one would think of as generalized interest, but they haven't caught on. And I don't think, incidentally, specificity means an awful lot anymore. A lot of very big song hits in the pop field are about very specific things, mentioning specific names. In fact, that's one of the things about the pop revolution, is that the songs over the last 25 years, as opposed to the pop songs of 50 years preceding it, are much more specific in terms of events, people's names, situations. A lot of the big song hits have been, little story songs, which was not true prior to the 50s. So I don't think that gets in the way at all. However, I never consider anything about the specificity of a song. Only once in my entire career, a word I hate, but of all the shows I've written, in Gypsy, Julie Stein asked me, he wrote the music for that, and I was just the lyricist. He asked me to change a line in Small World so that it could be sung by both a man and a woman, because I'd written it very specifically for a woman. But otherwise, I've never considered anything like that. If it's ever been done, it's been sort of a publisher's idea, not mine.
You write a song like My Friends, which is the song that Sweeney Todd sings to his razor blades, and it's a pre-murder, pre-revenge song. It's hard to imagine someone singing that, say, in their club act, and it meaning nearly the same thing that it does in the play. Does that bother you at all, knowing that such a wonderful song as My Friends probably wouldn't work in a stage act?
Yes, it does bother me that some songs are unlikely to be done except when the shows are done. Curious enough, it's not a song like that, because a lot of club acts are quite bizarre. I can see somebody setting that situation. That's not a hard situation to set up. You tell an audience, this next song I'm going to sing is a man who's been in prison, who was a barber, and he's come back, and he sees his razor blades for the first time, and here's the song. It's a very simple situation to set up, and an audience would fall into the fantasy easily. More to the point, I think, are those songs that involve more than one voice, songs that I'm extremely fond of, like Someone in a Tree from Pacific Overtures. I mean, that's just never going to be done except, like, at the concert tonight and whenever Pacific Overtures is done, which is very rarely. But on the other hand, the recording is the recording, and the wonderful thing about having a record of a show is it is literally that. It's a record of the show. And so anytime I or anybody else wants to hear that song, they can put the record on. But, of course, it would be nicer if it had a wider currency. No, that theater, like all theater homilies, it means nothing. No, generally, you walk out of the theater humming something for one of two reasons. Either you heard it before you went into the theater, either, in other words, it was a hit of some sort, or it's stolen from something, or reminiscent of something that you've heard, or it's played so many times during the course of the show that people hum it on the way out. Everybody has always accused me of, many people have, certainly all the critics, writing unhummable music. The end of the first act of Little Night Music, I was always surprised to go out in the lobby and hear everybody humming A Weekend in the Country. Well, the reason they were was they had just heard nine choruses of it, played one right after the other for the last 10 minutes of the act. So, of course, they went out humming it. You hear anything often enough, you hum it. You could certainly hum the Berg Violin Concerto if you hear it a few times. And generally, something that's hummable immediately doesn't last very long. Some of the biggest classic hit songs, like Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, didn't become popular until 10 years after it had been written. So hummability, I think, is a matter of how familiar it is when you come into the theater or how many times you hear it. That's why most of the composers of at least the, let's call it, up to and through Rodgers and Hammerstein had reprises in their shows. Well, Jerry Herman comes from that school, and in his new show, La Cage aux Folles, there are many reprises, and that gives an audience a chance to get familiar with the tune. I find the reprises are anathema generally because I don't think the characters undergo the same emotions, and when they do undergo a similar emotion, I would want to change the lyric, and as soon as you change the lyric, you're throwing the audience a little bit. You know, it's not the same thing as hearing Some Enchanted Evening sung six times. And I just find the situation seldom arises. So what I try to do is reprise motifs, which is, you know, an operatic technique. Instead of whole songs, you just keep playing individual themes and changing them throughout the show and hope that that will give the audience something to hold on to.
You frequently write with dissonant chords underneath the melody, and it's a beautiful effect. Do the chords and melody come to you at the same time?
Yeah, it's not a question so much at the same time, but I think the principle of compositional technique is that harmony is what music is about, and harmony is what gives it its structure. The melody usually relates to the harmony as opposed to vice versa. The fact is, you know, you can take almost any tune, simple diatonic tune, diatonic meaning something that's played, let's say, all on the white notes, meaning within the scale, and depending on how you set the harmony, the tune will take on entirely different colorations. Quite often some of the most interesting tunes in the world are not interesting just as melody. They're interesting when they are put together with their accompaniment. And, you know, a Schubert melody is not beautiful per se. It's beautiful because of where it is in terms of the harmony. And certainly Gershwin's music, as far as I'm concerned, is primarily harmonic music. I'd say it's the harmony that gives it its emotion, gives it its individuality of style, and is, for me, what's thrilling about it. So, in a sense, the answer to your question is yes, they come together, although I might get a melodic idea and have to find the harmony that the melody implies. More likely, I will find a harmonic progression or a sense of a harmonic progression combined, let's say, with a rhythmic progression, and out of that, a melody will grow. It's sort of the soil from which the melody springs. I don't think anybody just invents a tune. Even if you just made up a tune right now, you would hear harmony underneath it, even though you might not know, not being a musician, how to pick it out, but you would hear the harmony. You can't just hear a melody without relating it to where it is in the scale and in the harmonic structure.
Why is it so difficult to have hit musicals on Broadway now? Not many musicals seem to make it for very long, and it's so hard to get one produced in the first place.
Well, there have never been very many hit musicals in any season. It's rare. I mean, you know, two hit musicals a season is a very high average even 40 years ago. I mean, you know, the year the Brigadoon was done, I remember, I was in college, Brigadoon and Finian's Rainbow were the hits. You know, that's two hits, and there were many more musicals done. The real thing is there aren't very many musicals produced because they're so expensive to produce, so of course the number of hits is likely to be fewer. But there's at least one big musical hit every season, maybe two. So I don't think the hits have gone down. It's that the production, the amount of productions, has been lessened.
You think that's financial?
Entirely, sure. Oh, absolutely. The problem with writing for the theater is that it doesn't exist on the page or in the living room or at the piano. It exists only on a stage with an audience and performers as collaborators. And the only way, time-honored tradition, the way Puccini fixed his operas was you got to put it on, you got to look at it in front of an audience, and then you start tinkering with it, rewriting, fixing, changing. You cannot tell what's going to happen in that peculiar sea change between a rehearsal hall and on a stage, and not even the sea change between your living room and the rehearsal hall. As soon as you get actors and then you get an audience, everything changes. And so what's important to the young writer is the production. It's not just learning how to write. The way you learn how to write is through writing in front of an audience, not writing in a classroom or in a living room.
Do you consider audiences to be good judges of work? If one of your plays is a great success, do you think that makes it better than one of your musicals that closed in a few weeks?
Audiences tend to believe what the critics tell them. If a critic, particularly New York Times, has told them that a given line is funny, they'll start laughing at that line the next night just as the line begins. Or an actress will make an entrance and they'll give her a standing ovation simply because Frank Rich said that she was brilliant. So in that sense, audiences are fooled. On the other hand, and they are fooled over a period of time by production and by glitz, but if it's a serious audience, that is to say, if it's the kind of show that requires some give and take, I think audiences are fairly trustworthy in terms of basics. I don't think you can trust them to get a lot of the surface stuff because it depends on the level of their sophistication, education. Audiences in the first 3 months of a run are entirely different than the audiences a year later. New York audiences are hipper because they see more shows. The tourists come a year later or 6 months later, so the audiences get a little cooler, a little quieter. But you can tell about the quality of attention. That, I think, remains the same in all audiences. You can tell when an audience is listening to you and happy to be listening to you, and when an audience is not happy. And it's subtler than coughing or rustling of programs, which, of course, is dead giveaway. But even without that, the quality of attention, I think, is palpable, and therefore you can tell when they're following the story or whatever it is that you want them to follow. So in that sense, I think they're trustworthy. But they are misled a lot by glitz and critics.
Do you enjoy working? I mean, is it something you have to do, or do you actually enjoy that process of writing?
Oh, it's neither. I don't enjoy it that much, but I do sometimes. I like writing music. I don't like writing lyrics. And I like dreaming up shows. I don't like the rehearsal period, and I'm very lazy, so my answer is yes and no. I sort of like working. I like it sometimes, not others. And as any writer will tell you, as you must not know, I mean, it's sometimes a horrifying job because it's very lonely. But I'm in a collaborative profession, and that's why I do not write alone. That's why I like writing with librettists and being in a collaborative field.
You seem to have intentionally avoided the whole celebrity scene, People magazine scene, lots of the interviews, TV interviews, the whole bit. Why have you chosen to remain outside of that?
Well, I don't know what a writer is doing that anyway. I mean, if I wanted to be a celebrity, I'd be an actor or something like that, a performer, somebody out there in public. My idea is to stand in the dark in the back, and I don't have to stand there on stage with egg on my face. If the scene doesn't work, they can blame me, but it's the poor actors who have to take it. I wouldn't get up there and play one of those rotten scenes or sing one of those rotten songs and have the audience frown at me. I mean, the whole idea of being a writer is to sit in the dark. And so I don't understand. There are indeed writers who want to be celebrities, but not an awful lot of them. I don't know very many songwriters in the theater, anyway, who pursue celebrity. In fact, one of the few songwriters I know who's in the public eye is Leonard Bernstein, not as a songwriter, it's because he's a performer. He's a conductor and an artist, a musician, meaning he plays the piano. So it is natural I think if he were just a writer, he wouldn't be all that well-known either. But that's the reason. I mean, my idea of hell is the spotlight.
Do you think your audiences will ever get the chance to hear you singing your own songs? I know one record of Anyone Can Whistle has been released. I know you have many, many tapes of you singing all the songs you've written.
No, those are just for me and for the files. I sing very poorly. I sing with a great deal of passion, but you have to see me in operation to excuse the sound of the voice, which is, it's on pitch, but it's not the greatest sound in the world, and it depends on how much I've eaten, how big the range is, and it's unlikely. I, I don't mind doing it at a party, but I would never do it for publication.
Steve always auditions all his own work. And the thing he loves to do, when he has a new song, he wants you to come over and hear it. And when he's got a few, he'll say, come on over, I want to play you the song that I've written for you in such and such a place in the script. And you know, I'll pop over to his house and he'll sit down at the piano and he'll sing the song. He auditions his own shows and he doesn't have somebody else sing the songs, he sings them. Kills himself laughing when he was playing The Worst Pies in London. Can you imagine trying to play that and make all the sound effects and, you know, all the beats and so on, which are done with the dough and the rolling pin and all of that? He'd worked it all out. Every piece of business in that song Steve had written, it was right there on the music. She swaps the fly, she hits the dough, she, you know, she pops her mouth or whatever she does, you know, at that moment.
So does he have a good voice when he sings these
songs? Not particularly, no, not at all. But he has a serviceable voice, and it isn't a bad voice. It's fine, but it's not a singer's voice at all.
This is the third production you'd work with, which Stephen Sondheim was involved with. Do you feel like you've learned anything from
a tremendous
his
amount.
Instruction or lyric writing?
Yes, a great deal. I've learned how to... I've learned how to deliver a song and for the words to be understood, because he absolutely insists on it. And he knows exactly how he wants the song to be. It isn't that he tries to invoke his style on you or a style. It's simply that he wants certain musical details to be attended to. He wants you to breathe in certain places, and he's very explicit, very understanding, but nevertheless, he would like you to do it a certain way.